Okay. My name is Andy Borowski, and I'm chairman of Dominican. I want to welcome you all here to our Institute for Leadership for our lecture series. We do this in conjunction with Book Passage, which is a two-store book chain here and in San Francisco. And they are a total survivor of the book industry, and they're an example of when you do things right, you survive and you thrive. This lecture series is a partnership between the Borowski School of Business, the Institute for Leadership Studies, which is based there, and Book Passages. The Institute itself holds public forums like this one to engage our students, the campus, the community, and socially relevant discussions. And we highlight inspired acts of leadership across the disciplines. The partnership with Book Passages brought over 90 speakers to this area and to the stage here at Dominican. And it's a pretty remarkable group of people that have come. We've had Caroline Kennedy has come a couple times. David Brooks was here a couple weeks ago. Jack and Susie Welch are here tonight. And to bring people of the stature that the partnership has brought is really a unique thing. So I really want to thank Elaine Petrocelli, who owns Book Passages, and Book Passages for their commitment to the community and their commitment to Dominican and the great things that they can do. Our lead sponsor that helps pay for this is Private Ocean. And Private Ocean is a personal money management group. They're wealth management. They're the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firm in Marin. Richard Stone, one of its founders and principals, is a trustee at Dominican. And as one of our trustees, he has been very active, and Denise Lucy, who runs the Institute, brought him in to help sponsor these events. And without their financial support, some of this would be very hard to do. Tonight's lecture is also sponsored by California Bank and Trust and by the local office there. So I want to thank our sponsors for what they do for us. Our special guests tonight are Jack and Susie Welch. Jack is a former chairman and CEO of General Electric Company. And during his tenure, GE grew over 4,000% in value. And he also pioneered new models of leadership. And when Jack first started at GE, or shortly thereafter, I was just beginning my career. And when you think about ways of managing, ways of inspiring excellence, ways of taking a company like General Electric, which is one of the premier companies in the United States, and realizing that for GE to survive and thrive in the future, it had to change. And that's something that takes real leadership to do. And he inspired the people at GE to be better than they ever were, to be more relevant to society, to innovate in ways so that GE as a company would survive and thrive. And I think one of the things Jack always did was look out for the grand majority of people. And in his philosophy, he would always take the position, what's best for the bulk of the people and how I drive this organization forward is the right thing to do. And so today you have a company like GE that is still thriving. The people that Jack trained at GE have gone on to lead some of the best companies in the United States. And I think he inspired a whole team of managers and leaders across the country. Because when he did that, and it was a time when people just weren't doing that, it made it okay for other people. It made it okay for people to realize that they could be the best, that they could inspire their people that worked with them to be the best. That it made it okay to say, we have to do what's right, and right is it more important than doing what's easy. And that's the kind of leadership that he gave. And today, he has continued to work on things. He works with his wife today. They write books. They are incredible people. So today he is current executive chairman of Jack Welch Management Institute, and they have an online MBA program with more than 1,000 students. So he's a leader in learning how to do online education. His wife, Susie, is a Baker Scholar from the Harvard Business School. She joined the Harvard Business Review as senior editor in 1995 and was named editor-in-chief in 2001. She was a columnist for O, the Oprah magazine, for Bloomberg Businessweek, and has appeared on numerous TV shows as a business analyst and commentator. She's also author of the New York Times best-selling book 10-10-10, A Life-Transforming Idea. So we have two just very influential people here, and they really are going to bring some very relevant ideas to this group. They also write a weekly, co-write a weekly column called The Welch Way for Business Week magazine, and it's published by the New York Times Syndicate in more than 45 major newspapers around the world, reaching more than 8 million readers. They also co-authored Winning, which became a number one Wall Street Journal and international bestseller. And tonight they're going to discuss their new book, The Real Life MBA, Your No BS Guide to Winning the Game, Building a Team, and Growing Your Career. So I've talked a little bit about what they've done to influence my personal life. They're going to get interviewed tonight by one of my very best friends, Steve Bennett. And I met Steve and Marcia over 30 years ago at their first anniversary at Club Med. And Steve and I were tennis partners. And over the 23 years that he worked for GE, and over the rest of the years that we've continued to be friends, we've talked about business, we've talked about personal things. I've watched Steve grow and mature in his career. After 23 years with GE, being mentored by Jack, Steve honed his skills as a leader. He went on to be CEO of Intuit, which does Quicken, and from there also went to be CEO of Symantec. And he's been on the boards of numerous public companies, such as Sun Microsystems and Qualcomm's and some startups in Silicon Valley. To have the strength of character that Steve has and to do the things that he's done has been incredible for me to watch. And to see the training that Jack imparted on Steve and mentored Steve really tells how personal relationships within business are so important. So I think we're going to get an unusual interview tonight because these two people have been personal friends. They not only work together, but they like each other. And that's a really special thing, and business very often brings that forward. So I want you to all welcome now Steve Bennett and Jack and Susie Welch. So if you want to come out.
Thank you, Andy.
Well, hello, everybody, and thanks for coming. I, as Andy said, had the pleasure of practicing what I learned from Jack for 23 years at GE, and the stuff in the book that you read about is real. So let's get right to the book. Susie, thanks to you and Jack for coming. It's been 10 years since the last book that you co-wrote together. Kind of why now, why this topic, and what was the catalyst for writing, you know, this book?
Well, we're delighted to be here. Thank you so much for being here. We wrote this book because we believe there was no other book like it. I mean, it's pretty simple, right? It's pretty much an MBA in a box. And we didn't think, after looking around and poking around, that book existed. And we thought that having traveled the world over the past 15 years almost, we did a calculation, and we think pretty accurately about 1.25 million people traveling around the world speaking in groups this size, speaking to groups of 40,000, and really hearing the questions. And that led us to believe that a lot of things have changed in 10 years, and there's a real hunger for people to know how to make sense of it and how to run their organizations of every size, run them better. And so we thought, well, we have learned some stuff, and we know some stuff, and he's got a big brain, and I can type, so why don't we put it together and call it a book?
Not true.
I can type.
One of the things that you know, it's interesting for me because I get to read some of the stuff that I had heard previously, and then the new stuff, which was, I think, new insights as evidenced by the continuous learning for all of us. One of the new things was this concept of truth and trust, kind of a new definition, in my view, a simpler definition of leadership. What would you tell the audience about that concept, how that came about, and your thoughts on that?
Well, basically, you can read 1,000 books on leadership, and you have all these characteristics of passion, driven, excitable, team building, et cetera. But it really came down to we were sitting around writing about what have we really seen happen in this more transparent world today. I mean, transparency is at levels we've never had before, with social media, with everything. Everybody knows everything. And so the old idea of having a little power is no longer a factor in your leadership characteristics. You've got to be able to engage, embrace, involve every person in the agenda, if you will. And that takes a lot of truth-telling, takes a lot of trust-building, because people can see right through you in any kind of an organization. So the idea of constantly, if you had your druthers, you'd put a sign in every conference room, truth only here, no spin, no negotiation, no budget meetings, not all that corporate stuff that goes on, that just clouds the game. You would have a truth serum injected in everybody, you'd be faster, you'd get to the better decision, all these things would happen. But in order to have truth in a corporation, you really have to have, or in any organization, a school, you desperately need a trust. You've got to have shown you've got people's back. They can make mistakes. They don't get shot. You're with them all the way, and you all kinds of flexing of that trust muscle over and over and over again if you're going to get the truth, because the truth sometimes is very painful. And it takes real action and guts to bring it up. And in corporations, it's really scary.
What had happened was we were coming to the chapter on leadership. The book really sort of in many ways organized like an MBA with the sections on alignment, on finance, on marketing, on crisis management. There's a section on your career and so forth. But we were getting to the requisite chapter on leadership. And we thought, what have we really learned? You know, the dynamics of business have really changed. Organizations are formed more quickly. There's a lot more entrepreneurship going on. And what really does work? And, you know, there's a book on leadership written every day. And there's just so much stuff out there. And, you know, look, a lot of it's true. And a lot of it is right. But what does it all come down to? And we start to think about the organizations that really worked. And it is this culture of truth and trust. And very early on the book tour, we're coming towards the end of it now, but early on the book tour, just sort of spontaneously, we were talking about truth and trust. And a lot of times you're in a very large room and it's dark and you can't see the audience's face at all. So you're sort of speaking into a dark blackness. And but we were in this one room and for some reason all the house lights were up so we could both see everybody's faces in the audience. And so very spontaneously after talking about truth and trust, I said, you know what I think would be a great exercise would be if all of you go back to your workplaces and have a meeting and talk about whether or not you've got truth and trust. And I mean, to say the faces were completely stricken, right? It was like people were like, you know, I think they were in their minds having that exercise. And it was a group of managers. And that's a pretty scary question to face into. Do we have truth and trust here? And it feels great when you do, but you know it when you don't.
And as I read that, I mean, the ceaselessly seeking truth and relentlessly building trust is the note I made. But one of the things I learned, and again, practicing and learning and screwing up and learning, all these things, is that many of these skills apply not just to your business career, but to your personal life. That was the power of a lot of this stuff to me. So truth and trust is something that's much broader than just business.
That's so true.
One of the other things that I struggled with when I came out here from GE is we had a lot of talk about values. And everybody wanted to talk about the values. And so you wrote a chapter about behavior versus values, which is something I inherited when I came out here, because values are kind of a mystical thing. What would you share? And they're important, incredibly important. What insights would you share about and why you talked about behaviors versus values?
Because in a corporation, when you get into values, you can swing from politics to religion to anything on the broad spectrum of things. We assume you have character. We assume you have all that. But we want to know, as when you think about a business strategy, you define a mission. That's where you're going to go. Why you want to go there. That's the definition of what a mission really is, and it should be in real language, not fluffy, airy, fairy language. And the how you get there are the behaviors. So, for example, if you've got a company that's bureaucratic, et cetera, you've got to put a value in there. If you want to get rid of it, you want to get faster, hate bureaucracy and the bureaucrats that practice it. You got to describe the behavior you want. You want speed, you got to get speed. If you want people who want to promote people, like I think one of the great attributes of a leader, and we've got that in the book, is this idea of a generosity gene. Think of all the bosses you've worked for in your life. Did they have a generosity gene? Now, Susie will correct me and say this.
We don't know if it's a gene, okay, but it's a...
But basically, it's somebody who relishes your good ideas, praises you for them, promotes them up and doesn't take credit for them, who loves to give you raises, who gets turned on giving you a stock option, who gets turned on seeing you promoted. It's a big deal. They'll run, and good leaders, and I've had the scrimpiest, tightest managers in the world, and I've had the most generous in the world. And I'll tell you, one's a hell of a lot better than the other. And you've all been through that with a boss that doesn't have your interests at heart. But when your boss has your interests at heart, your whole behavior about them changes. Truth comes out, you'll go the extra mile, you'll love being there. We have a lot in the book about leaders having to make your place the coolest kid's basement. You know, where you hung out in high school, where you always hung out with those kids. That's where you want your place to be. When people leave a company to go to another company, they weren't getting what they needed in your place. And that's your responsibility.
One of the things that you referred to, again, that was important and is this alignment concept. And whether you're a small business with 5 employees or 2 bookstores, alignment of everybody on the common mission is really critical to high performance. What insights would you share from the book for people about alignment?
Well, you know, one of the things we've noticed, and it's noticed traveling around, was how much of a grind work had become to a lot of people. That especially after the 2008 recession, just people felt like they were treading water. Now, interestingly, we've been out here in California, and we've spent a couple of days in Silicon Valley. Then we went up to Seattle, and this is a beautiful bubble world where a lot of people have work that is very rewarding, and they're in organizations that are growing, and there's a great sense of possibility.
Try Chicago, Kansas City, and Minneapolis.
Right. So, you know, we've been out in the real world. So it's...
Triumph.
I mean, it is just, it's actually sort of funny to talk about this to we went to LinkedIn and we went to Google and we were like, we actually aren't going to discuss this with you guys because they just, the world is just so filled with possibility. But the fact remains that a lot of times, too many people are in situations where the company seems at a complete standstill. And even within a very high functioning team, a team can seem at a standstill. And so the problem almost invariably is the lack of alignment. And alignment is the situation when the mission is well known and everyone gets it, they understand it, it's graphic to them, it's detailed, it's gritty, they get what the mission of the organization is. And then they actually also know what the behaviors are. Again, we like the word behaviors better than values. The behaviors are that the organization believes are going to get you to the mission. Speed, urgency, promoting people, creativity, innovation, whatever. You got to pick 5 and stick with them, right? And then the final incredibly critical piece, which is where most companies fall down, is that there are consequences. There are consequences, both good and bad, really, when you know the mission and have the behaviors. And if you know the mission and you demonstrate the behaviors and you have great performance, then the consequences are up, 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 up with you. And if you poo-poo the mission, and you are you have your own set of values and your own set of behaviors, and you don't believe in it. One of the behaviors is love the customer, and all you do is criticize them and cynical and snark on them. I mean, the consequence is that you are either coached into changing those behaviors, or you're asked to go find an organization where snarkiness is accepted. All four of those organizations, and so this idea that there should be alignment between mission, behaviors, and then consequences for it is what stops the grind. It's what unlocks performance. It's what galvanizes organizations and companies.
Let me put it in some broader context for a minute. If you take the Gallup survey, which is done every quarter, since 2008, they survey 12,000 random workers across the country. Not 12,000 in Silicon Valley, 12,000 across the country. And the numbers come out in a way that 65% of American workers today are disengaged with the work. They don't like going to work. They don't like being there. Think how many hours are spent. Now, if you believe like we do that business is a game and the team with the best players wins, think about that. And now you got 65% of your team on the sidelines or staying in the dugout. You haven't got a hell of a good chance of winning.
And remember that these numbers, these Gallup numbers, these are people self-describing as disengaged.
Yeah.
So, you know, there may be a boss looking around saying that person's not engaged, that person's not. But these are people who themselves say, I don't care about work.
Every quarter you'll see that it hasn't moved since 2008. And the discouragement is so severe. And you've got to get people on the same page, going after the same game, to be in the winner's locker room, not the loser's locker room. That's what it's all about. And you've got to create an atmosphere in your company, whether it's a bookstore, a bakery, a thousand other things. You've got to get people to want to be in the winner's locker room, and they've got to want to get there with you. And that is your job. And when you think about that, that's what alignment's all about, getting people on the page, buying into the mission, going with the behaviors, and then getting the consequences.
And that's what one of the reasons why we think what a leader should do, and again, a leader of a large organization or just a team, that one of their jobs is chief meaning officer. You know, people really want their work to have meaning, and they want to see the meaning of their work. They want to know how their work is connected to a larger context. You know, one of my great tricks for hiring people at the Harvard Business Review was, you know, they could go to a lot of magazines, and I wanted really good writers and editors to come work for me. And I believed our mission was to improve the practice of management, and I would say to people I was trying to recruit, come join us and change the world. And I didn't say to them, come join us and edit articles for our monthly magazine. I said, come join us. And people want meaning. And your job as a leader, a leader of two people or 20 people or 200,000 people, is to make work have meaning. And that leads to engagement and alignment.
And that's, I think, is in this book in spades. Yeah. You know, do you give people a purpose for being there? Getting up, coming there, are you celebrating it up? You know, Steve knows this story, but when I was in GE, I always was pushing for more celebrations. Every little victory, have a celebration, get a keg, do something, but make people feel better about their work. And I screamed that for like 15 years. And the last week I was at Crotonville, our education center, I'm there for my last visit there with 150 young students, middle managers, younger managers. And I asked them, now you think they know I'm after this desperately. I'm leaving the company. And I say, how many of you have celebrated in the last year? How many of you think you celebrated enough? I didn't get half the hands. Half, they think you would have thrown me a bone to get me the hell out of there, you know? And nothing happened. People have to, you know why it is? I'm convinced of it. I've asked enough people now. I'm convinced people don't want to celebrate you in the first row here because the third row might be offended. And I don't want to stand up and highlight you because I don't have a reason to. yes, you should explain why you're being celebrated and they're not.
It gets back to truth and trust.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the one thing that we really jump on in the book is when we go around and we ask people, where do you stand with your managers? Now, we've been in Vegas with 40,000 people in the audience, and we've been in smaller places. And you ask them, we've talked to over 1.25 million people in the last 10 years, and in Q&As, and you ask them, how many of you go to work every day and know exactly what your boss thinks about you, what your career profile looks like, and where you're going to be? You don't get 10% of the audience. We were in Chicago the other night.
Yeah. Right?
4 people out of 600.
600.
In a crowd. And 4 people knew where they stood in their company. And that's not unusual.
It's now, we did this at Google. Okay, so we then went out to Silicon Valley. Of course, everybody was sitting there with their manager because we were speaking in the Googleplex. And we got the highest, 60%, I'd say, yes. The highest we've ever seen.
But I'll tell you, at the end of the session, the guy who was with us, was the head of HR, and he said, this is frustrating. I've only got 60% who know what the hell they're going.
And we actually think there's a moral obligation to letting your people know where they stand. And actually, a good friend of mine, I sort of run a board with her, and she said, I read the book, I love the book, and yeah, thank you so much. And then we're chit-chatting away, and so she says, well, I've just hired this guy. He's been a good friend of mine, and it's not working out. And I said, well, you read the book, Emily. You need to tell him. And she said, oh, I don't want to hurt his feelings. It would be just terrible. But I am being very passive-aggressive with him. I said, come on. You know, you've got to let him know where he stands, because what is really the kind thing to do? People want the truth. Don't you want the truth? And so you've got to turn to the people who were and say, look, this is what you are doing really well, and this is what you could be doing better. This is what your future looks like. And even though that first conversation is like going into a cold bath because you've not done it before, it is the moral obligation of any leader to do that.
One of the things that struck me in a different topic in the book, and actually there's some audience questions that I have already that we'll get to in a second, really hit on this area of destiny concept. And Susie, I know that's something that you have some passion for, including one of your sons in the book that was the music, that was his passion. What insight would you share here? Because it applies to new graduates, recent graduates, or people that are still searching for the right career path.
Yeah, go through it.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about what area of destiny is. Area of destiny is a concept that we have in this book. You know, you write a book, and the book has 60, 70 concepts in it, and then you go on the road with the book, and you never really know which of the concepts are going to pop and which are really going to grab the people who've read it, and you start hearing on Twitter and so forth. And I have to say, Area of Destiny is a much more surprise and delight, the biggest concept that's come out of this book. So let me just describe it a little bit. It's about career management, and it's really about life management. When Jack and I are on the road, we can go to a crowd of people, and they can all be seemingly incredibly successfully, highly employed people, and we will still get people in the audience come up to us afterwards or during the speech, raise their hand and say, I'm not really sure what I should be doing with our lives, with my life. And I'm working and I'm doing X, Y, but it just doesn't feel right. I'm in the suit that doesn't fit me. And so we had come to develop this construct that very simple but powerful. It's like this. Imagine your life as two superhighways, if you will. And on one superhighway is what you're uniquely good at, what you're better at than most people, okay? And that can be something like, I'm very good at making strangers feel welcome. I'm very good at persuading people. I'm very good at solving math problems with 7 variables. I'm very good. I mean, you're uniquely good at something. And you've been good at it for a long time, probably because you've been practicing and because you knew you were good at it. Look at this other superhighway. It is what you love doing. You know, if you think back to the last month, was it hanging out with people, reading a book, solving a problem, making somebody feel better, whatever. Something, the things you really love doing. And when you intersect what you are uniquely good at and what you love spending your time doing, you create this piece of beautiful real estate, which is where you should build your career and your life. And very unfortunately, even though that makes intuitive sense probably to everyone here, that to overlap your strengths and passions with what you love doing, right? A lot of people end up having careers that are built on momentum, or expectations, you know, and they end up being doctors, lawyers, or whatever, because that was the expectation or that was the momentum and they were pretty good at it. And then they're 45 years old and they have a big fat midlife crisis. And sometimes you can get out of it and get into your area of destiny, and sometimes you can't. So we like Area of Destiny because we think it's a big midlife crisis preventer. So, we have a lot of stories in the book about people who have built lives in their Area of Destiny. But our favorite story, which we got permission to use, is with our own son, who's a very good case of Area of Destiny. Because here was a kid who was quite good at science in high school, and he was good. He liked geology, he liked astronomy, and he's a talented kid, a very capable kid, and so he applies to and gets accepted early decision to Cornell, where he's going to major in geology, he thinks. That's the science he likes the most. Off he goes. Then he gets to Cornell freshman year, and what happens first semester when he signs up for all the classes, earth science classes you've got to take? Well, he meets the kids who are really uniquely good at science, okay? He meets the kids from Pakistan and India and Canada and from all around the world who are uniquely good at science. He comes home shell-shocked. I mean, he didn't know how to face us. He was like, this is gonna be ugly. Because they were really, really good, and he was just pretty good. But he was interesting because he actually did have a unique talent, and he had had it since he was really young. Bizarre. Unique talent, and everybody commented on it, we knew about it, and we just thought it was going to be his hobby. But he was bizarrely good at picking out which bands were going to be huge. So you'd be driving in the car with him at age 9, and he would say, like, this band's good, like, weird, at 9, this band's going to be huge. And then 2 years later, they'd win Grammy for best. I mean, he was what we've come to find out is called an ear. So that, we said to him, since he was going to get all D's in science and it was really looking ugly, we said, why don't you, and we said to him, why don't you go get a summer job in the music business? And he loved music. He had had a radio show at that point for 4 years. He had 2 radio shows a week at Cornell. Go get a job in the music industry. He quickly is able to get himself a job at SiriusXM, the satellite radio station. They have internships. They actually hired him on the phone because they couldn't believe this kid who was like a savant about music. And to make a long story short, he went back to Cornell, changed his major to music, and is right now looking at 3 fabulous job offers in the music industry, which is where he belongs. And I say to him, you've got to thank us for preventing the big midlife crisis that you're never going to have. It's like, thank you, thank you, thank you. But, you know, he loved it. And after his first summer at SiriusXM, Jack and I were home one night, and we were thinking, why isn't he home from work? Why isn't he home from work? He blows through the door around 9 o'clock, glowing, inner glow. This is like 3rd, 4th week after working in the radio business. And he says to us, like, work is great. We said, that's great, Marcus. This is such a good sign. He goes, no, work is really great. And they really like me. I could quit school right now. And we were like, that is not happening. So,
we have a story in the book of a guy who worked for us. We have a private equity company with 74 companies, now 24 companies. We've been through 74. And he was a senior vice president at Hertz. And he would come into our meetings. We owned Hertz. We owned a big piece of Hertz. And he'd come in, and he'd be in a suit and tie. It was in New Jersey. This guy was choking. He was coming out of his suit every day. He hated being there. And he would go through the ritual with us. He was a terrific leader. But he was always talking about marathons and about his physical fitness. He was totally ripped. He was absolutely in great shape. And one day he came in and he wanted to see me after the main meeting. He said, I'm bailing out of here. I said, what? He's making about $600,000. He had a good salary, doing a good job. We loved him. He said, I'm getting out of here. Said, what do you mean you're getting out of here? He said, I'm gonna go work. I found my job. I'm gonna go work for
Equinox.
The fitness chain.
I don't know if it's out in the West Coast.
Took a salary cut of a half and became number 3 person at Equinox. And we see him now. We're writing this book. We're asking him about it. He's the happiest guy alive. He's making half the money, having this wonderful life, and he's not in a suit.
And all day long, he hangs
sweaty
out.
Sweaty guys all day. Yeah. And he's running every marathon you can get your hands on.
And hanging out with people who do it. I follow him. We're friends on Facebook. So I get to see every single day him saying things like, another great day to be alive. And so, you know, here's a guy. He really blew up his life, though, to get into his Area of Destiny.
One of the things that you focused on so much that, and the reason you were so successful and the challenges that you took on at GE is decision making and judgment. And you talked a lot about that and spent a lot of time testing, probing, seeking truth. But you took it to another level in this book with globalization, and at least that was my interpretation. You took it up a level to something that you called discerning judgment, because of the complexities now and how hard business has gotten. What would you say about judgment and kind of the elevation of the importance to discerning judgment?
Well, we've been through, and you have too in your career, we've been through appointing people that were 26 or 30 to go overseas or to do a job here. We promoted the person who was 55 and he wanted to semi-retire and go over there. We hired all types, and everybody looks at what do you hire in the end. In the globalization chapter, it's all about putting the right people in those jobs. It isn't every place, but in a global assignment, it's more than ever. And what do you have to do in a global assignment? You have to be able to deal with the local culture while you're dealing with the headquarters culture. And one's pulling, one's pushing, and you have to say to headquarters, shut up, I'm not doing it. You have to have the courage to do that sometimes. And you have to, on the other hand, sometimes say to the local custom, we're jamming this one. We know we are. It's not the greatest thing here. So we have, we talk in the book a lot about Disney. excuse me, the decisions Disney has made over the years, many times, pushing and pulling. For example, in Japan, Disney always has a greeter in the store, in the front. Well, in Japan, they didn't want to have a greeter because greeters there would embarrass the person as they came in, and they'd feel they'd have to do something when they were grabbed by a customer coming in. And so what they did was Disney headquarters overruled the local people and said, we're doing it. That's Disney. That's our way. Now, they did that in Japan, and it worked like a charm, and all Japanese stores now do it. They copied Disney. On the other hand, they went to China, in Hong Kong, and if those of you who've been to Hong Kong know that people like to eat together all at once in groups. It's a common custom there. And there, Disney wanted to have staggered lunches in all the parks and things. And the Chinese said, no, we're not doing it. We won't do it. And so Disney had to hire X number of shifts, more people, all that, because they were smart enough to know that they weren't going to jam that one home because those people wanted. But that takes courage and judgment, a lot of discernment. So that word discernment is something that's new to think about. But you think about it now in the complex game we're in now in a global environment where you've got to have a win-win situation. It's the only way to go global is to be sure that the locals are winning and the headquarters is winning. And you've got to have somebody that can use that fine tuning and not some eager beaver manager with some of the qualities you like in a factory in Pittsburgh in the middle of Hong Kong or elsewhere. And it's discernment. It's really having that touch to know what's what there. So that's what we're really talking about.
Let's shift to some questions from the audience here. We've got some good ones. In developing organizational leaders, how important is formal education, classes, workshops, compared to on-the-job learning? And is there some kind of ratio, or how would you think about that?
There's no perfect answer. Some guys drop out of school at 17 years old and build companies and have great successes and never saw a management book. Some people have it innately. Some people played ball and knew from the first day how to lead people and gather them. From the playground, from the first day on the playground, they knew how to handle in interactions. So there's no formula, Steve, to that. I happen to believe in big companies, if you want to get alignment and you want to get that thing done, you've got to educate people on where you're going, why you're going there, back to that story again, and you've got to define the behaviors that are going to win in this company. And people have to know what behaviors win and what don't.
You know, one of the things that people ask us a lot about this book is, oh, since you wrote this book, does this mean you don't believe in an MBA? And the answer is absolutely not. We do belong. I have an MBA. MBAs in Jack is a school that is an MBA program. So we MBA has its time and place in some people's lives. I had a very traditional MBA, but not everybody has the time and flexibility and the finances to go back for 2 years to a leafy campus, give up their job, and also pay those outrageous tuitions. And that's why there are new kinds of education, like the online school that Jack runs, for different kinds of business models around education. One thing I will say about formal education versus on-the-job training is there's a funny thing that happens in school that actually sort of makes you bad at work. And that is that at school, you get ahead by raising your hand and being the one who gets called on, and you go, oh, it's me, and then you get called on, you get the A for that. But when you become a leader, actually, it has to be about your people and them answering the questions. And you'll get the reflected glory of them succeeding. But all that instinct that you had in school, which was to be the one who got the A and raised it, that you have to bury that. And we've noticed time and time again in building companies that the really hard transition, the place where people fall down, is that moment where they're transitioning from being an individual contributor to a manager. And the ones who make it, sometimes it really surprises you. Because the really, really, really good individual contributor can't make that transition that it's not about them anymore.
Yeah, I found that transition. And then the second one is the difference between managing individual contributors and managing managers. That's a tough transition, too.
Yep.
The only thing I would add to this, too, from what I learned from you, is that the operating mechanisms you run to use to run your organization are not really formal education, but they really are reinforcing vehicles about to get alignment,
the rhythms.
And that was actually something that I learned at GE that I brought to the companies out here that I ran that really helped us drive change faster to get alignment.
Yeah.
Welcome to Marin.
Thank you.
One of the audience
so
members.
Beautiful.
All right, so this
what
is,
a place,
this is,
a,
this is kind of a loaded question. Well, you see why all of us like to live out here.
Yeah.
What three things would you encourage the U.S. government to do to jumpstart our stagnant economy?
Well, clearly, free money isn't doing it. You know, zero money is not doing the job. What we've found, and I don't want to go on a rant here, it's a nice evening. But
I know, please don't.
I won't. But what we have found as we've gone around is the most incredible, incredible burden of regulation that's been put into little small business. I knew about regulation with big companies. Big companies can handle it. They got lots of lawyers. They got lots of people to manage it. But the little small shops in Kansas City where there's a jewelry store and the National Labor Relations Board's in there trying to fight with them about exempt versus non-exempt pay. The guy in Chicago who's out in Moline, Illinois, with a McDonald's, and they're trying to make him pay the wages of the headquarters. All the franchisees, they're trying to change the law that franchises must pay the franchisor pay at headquarters. So all the McDonald's people have got to pay what they pay at headquarters. And all these rules that were never around, I know about EPA, and I know about Dodd-Frank, and I know about banks' troubles, but I had no appreciation for these mom-and-pop shops that are being beat up by brutal regulators who've gotten some authority and some excitement, and what they're doing to little tiny
companies. It has a very chilling effect on employment, on job creation. Like this woman that we saw in Kansas City, their jewelry store, she said, I'm just afraid to hire anyone. I'm just afraid to hire because I'm just getting nailed with the rules. So that we really have experienced
that.
So
regulation, for one, is clearly going to be looked at. Is the regulation meaningful, or is it just some bureaucrat who's finally flexing his or her muscles down in the lower levels, or is it a job creator? And balance the two. There's got to be regulation. There's no question. But the torture they're putting small businesses through is frightening.
One question about innovation and risk-taking, and since you've been at the Googleplex, you probably got to see and LinkedIn saw that in action. How would you think we have some public sector employees that are here now? How would you think about spearheading innovation and risk-taking into the public sector? What could be done
No, I don't know if that's possible.
Oh!
Is that an oxymoron?
I'm not strong enough.
When
I retired, I took on a job as training young minority principals, African-American, Hispanic principals, in their 20s with Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. And we came up with a deal to give these people a chance by giving them degrees at a young age. We got Baruch College in New York to allow them to become principals. Mm-hmm. I'd go over there and we'd teach 50 at a time. They were the most attractive, aggressive, hungry people in the world. We'd come to a room like this and we'd have the graduation. Mike and I would give them the diplomas. They were in their mid to late 20s by this time. And 6 months later, we would have a reunion. They were the most depressed, sad. The families were not there anymore, but they had been beaten by the teachers union. They had been pulverized, where they couldn't do this, they couldn't do that. They had walkouts. So the public sector unions are killing education. Whether we want to admit it or not, that's the fact. And it's a real, real problem for minorities in particular, are being stuck in these schools, in these big cities that are not fair. It isn't fair.
Makes innovation very hard.
Innovation's brutal.
So this deals with area of destiny. Maybe there's some additional insight, Susie, you might have on, I can't seem to find the right career path. I want to do something I'm genuinely passionate about.
Right.
Why is it so hard to find? What have you learned or insights would you have? Because, you know, those are discussions I have with people
frequently. Well, if that's happening, I think that you're just editing yourself too much. I mean, I think that there's just that great line, you know, what would you do if everything was possible, if you thought nothing was impossible? If you can't... In general, what we found is when somebody says, I can't figure out what my passion is that they just can't say it out loud. They can't, they just edit themselves too much. We have an older son, actually, on this point. So he went to Stanford, he did incredibly well, and we had all these great plans for him. He was going to be this, he was going to be that, because he was one of these sort of super kids, right? And he came out of Stanford, and he just was like, I don't know what my passion is. He sort of floated around for a couple of years, and we were losing our minds. Because I was like, just go get a great job. Look at all your natural resources, we used to say to him. And he was a kid who was saying, like, but my, you know, I don't know what my passion is. Well, you know, actually, he really did have a passion. And he just didn't, he couldn't really say it to us. And part of it was us, because we just couldn't receive it. From when he was 12 years old, he had been playing, even younger actually, he'd been playing this game, which some of you may know, called Magic the Gathering. It's sort of like a bridge for the science fiction set. It's made by the same company that makes Dungeons and Dragons. He was wildly passionate about this game. He played in tournaments, he played every minute he got. And so finally, in frustration, we said to him, go get a job at that company. And he did. And he's incredibly happy.
He got an entry-level job,
right.
$10 an hour. And he's now making $20 an hour, and he's the happiest guy alive. We just saw him in Seattle. And he's flying high, but he could never tell us. We weren't going to let him go play games.
And now he stays after work 3 days a week, because that's what they like the employees to do, and they all play the game with each other. And he's with his people. And he actually said to us, there's nothing, I can't imagine working any other place. So I think if you're saying,
and
I don't.
And this is, let me give you a little more color. This is a preppy kid with button-down shirts and cheat Cheetos, and now he's with people with purple hair, with nose rings, with everything, and he's the happiest guy alive.
He is.
So he got out of the costume we were dressing him in. And got into what his passion is.
Yeah. And he said to us, I can't imagine ever working anywhere else. And we said, I can't imagine either. And he's truly with his passion. So sometimes we edit our passions because of the people around us. So maybe that's it.
One of the other things that I jotted and not done that I saw as a change, what I thought was would have helped me if I would have probably learned this, you know, 20 years ago, which is part of the problem when I read the book. I said, I get the new stuff. And I said, I could have applied that and been more effective. But one of the things that lots of people struggle with is work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And you introduced a new concept that resonated very well with me, made a lot of sense, and you called work-life choice. Talk a little bit about how you came up with that or where that came from and why that came about.
You can talk about it.
Well, yeah, you can give examples, but I mean, we had a fascinating conversation at the Commonwealth Club today. We had 250 people. A majority were women there, and that question came up big time. Talking to me about work-life balance. And I said, there is no such thing as work-life balance. There are work-life choices. You have to make choices all the time. Sometimes it's all work, sometimes it's all home, sometimes it's all play, sometimes it's, but you, every choice has a consequence. And when you make that call, nobody's saying your call is wrong or right. It's a very personal thing. You own it, and you've got to own it. You can't expect a company to all of a sudden be sitting back saying, how do I give you exactly the right balance? That's your choice. That's your decision in life. And I went through this with these people today, but they had a lot of questions back and forth. At the end of the conversation, which would not have happened 10 years ago, they all stood up and applauded. It was wild. Because today people realize that there are choices all the time. And I also used another analogy. The more shit, you'll feel guilty sometimes at work, and you'll feel guilty when you're home that you're not at work. You'll feel guilty at work that you're not at home. But back and forth all the time. And that's male and female today. It's not just women. And that whole subject is now open for conversation. You had something today at Microsoft.
Yeah, actually.
What did you use for a word?
He called it Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, was talking about this today, and he called it work-life integration. He also said what we say, which is, what is work-life balance? Is there something you've got to keep 50% of work and 50% at home? I mean, what if you want 80 and 20? What if you want 20 and 80? And he talked about finding a solution for yourself that integrates work and life in the way that matches your values, not someone else's values, not society's values, your values. And, you know, there is this sort of problem, which is there's a period in your life for both men and women when work really needs you and your kids really need you, if you have kids, okay? And a lot of times work-life balance is about kids. And there I was with my four young children. I was a single mom for a while before I met Jack and he adopted my children, but I was a single mom with these four young kids. And I was working full-time, and it was unbelievably hard. Because why? Because my four kids desperately wanted me and work desperately wanted me, and I made the decision to be a working mother. I made that choice. I knew there would be consequences. Interestingly, both my sisters at the same time, both educated as I was, both dropped out of the workforce. They decided to stay home with their kids. And they, it wasn't as if I wasn't feeling enough guilt as it was, because it is, you know, you feel sick constantly. I mean, I sort of had 20, well, I sort of got it together, but I had 5 years where I was just constantly, when I was at work, I was sick about not being with the kids, and when I was with the kids, I was sick about what I was missing at work. It was just awful. And my sisters just piled right on, okay? And they were like, you know, and then one of my sisters went so far as to try to write an editorial for the Boston Globe, we were living in Boston at the time, that explained her decision that she asked me, of all people, to edit it. I was like, no. You know, you have to find someone else to edit this piece about your decision. Interestingly, you know, the dust settles, and all of our children are grown now. And if there was a linear connection between how much you worked and how your kids turned out, then this would be easy. But there is no direct connection. It's individual to your choices, your values, how you live your family, how you live your life. So this is why we call it work-life choices. There are choices, and then there are consequences, and then there's luck, and all sorts of other things that are all mixed in. It all comes out in the wash.
One last question for, if you were in the audience now, and the book is really, I think, very well laid out, like Susie mentioned, an MBA, class, How to Do Marketing and Finance, which I think is self-explanatory in the book, so I didn't ask questions about that. Go back to alignment and behavior. What advice would you give to the members of the audience if they use this as a catalyst to say, hey, I want to go back and really think about, do I have it? You know, how do I really kind of apply this concept in my organization? What advice would you have to folks that are here tonight to overcome, not their workforce at 65%, that they have a different workforce, but what would you tell folks to make this real? What would be the things you would
say you go back to that first principle we say of a leader, chief meaning officer. You would absolutely make sure all of your people in your organization who came to work, why are they there? Where are we going with it? And what's in it for them? One of the things that people don't spend anywhere near enough time in management, they always talk about, let's change. We got to change now. We got a new boss. Have you ever seen a boss show up and didn't say, I want to change? Impossible. But change is hard. And so they never go to the next step. What's in it for the person? So everybody in your organization ought to know what's in it for them if everything goes right. Is it more money, better joy, more promotions, more job security? But you have an obligation to give work purpose and meaning. And that is something that you cannot abdicate. Your people will respect you for it, they want to know it. But be sure you don't leave out what's in it for them when you win the game.
You came up with a new CMO role, Chief Meaning Officer, right, in the book that you talked about. Well, the last thing I wanted to say is I actually can tell all the folks in the audience that the stuff that if you read the book, as I did, this is real stuff. I mean, I just went back, and this will be... I went back through my file, and I looked at all of the, because I'm sitting up here with Jack, who has the, we don't know if it's a gene or not, but we've got to call it the generosity gene. And I just actually went back and looked at all the handwritten notes that Jack sent me. And I never reported directly to Jack. I was, at the end, one layer between Jack and I. And, you know, the most impressive thing about this started, you know, for the last 10 years of my career, all handwritten notes. It's something actually that I stole shamelessly from you. And then as I traveled around and saw what was happening in people's cubicles, they all had those notes posted. So I want you to know that I still have every note that you ever wrote to me. And the most impressive thing for me about Jack Welch is two of these notes came after I left GE after 23 years when I was the CEO of Intuit. And it was something as simple as, nice article in Forbes. Congrats on what you're doing. So the stuff in this book is real, and I was fortunate enough to live it for 23 years, which is why I'm so glad that you came to Dominican tonight to share your thoughts, Susie. It was great having you here. Nice to see you again, and Andy, let me turn it back over to you.
Well, it's been a long time since I got my MBA, and I got another education tonight. And what I said before at another reception we were at was that education is where GE was 30 plus years ago, and that we need to rejigger education, higher ed, and all through our schools. And Jack talked about that tonight. And as I sat here and I was listening about ways to inspire people, that's what we as trustees of a university or our administrators or our deans or our faculty has to do. We have to figure out and take lessons from what we learned tonight. How do we rejigger education so that we make more people connected with society and bring them forward? And Jack and Susie, I have to tell you, as I sat here and I listened, and I really felt like I was kind of back in school, but with a smile, because it wasn't like hard learning, it was like, oh, this stuff makes sense. And so I hope everybody that's here had kind of the same experience as I did, because learning, education, is all about learning new things and new ways of looking at things. And to be able to sit and listen to someone who is able to explain those things to us, two people that really did a great job, and Steve, and so three people, experiences and ways of looking at the world is incredible. So I want to thank you. This was, for me, and I hope for everybody here, just a great experience. So thank you.